opportunity to read and to study your word. We hope as students today, we grow our faith and improve our understanding of what you have left for us. Give us the ability to not only understand it, but opportunity to share it. And allow our lives to become more like your Son, so that in our speech, in our interaction, in our trust, in our look towards you, we behave and live as citizens of the kingdom transformed by the gospel of your Son's grace. Forgive us of our sins, and this is our prayer in your Son's name. Amen. All right, so as I mentioned, we're in chapter 19. Particularly, we are looking at section of verses 28 to 48. So about 20 verses this morning is the intended reading space. It is Luke's account of what we broadly refer to as the triumphal entry of the Christ into Jerusalem. And there's a couple of things that I think are important historically in the context of the first century for us to pay attention to. How many of you at some point in your life have either been present for or part of a victory parade where a winning team comes back into town and the town shows out for it? I know I've been part of both sides of that. So I've been a participant in the parade, and I've also been on the sidelines watching that. What about y'all? Have you guys been part of something like that? Small town, big town? Some of you are like, oh, we don't do that around here. Or I can't remember ever doing that. How many, one more. How many of you have seen it on the news for the Braves? That's a recent thing, right? So you think about that for a moment. There's a certain level of that that I've always felt like there was a little bit odd, right? And there's something like, I didn't, as the spectator, I didn't do anything for those games, really. I mean, I showed up maybe to one or two of the games that they played in. Maybe the winning state championship game I wouldn't supported friends or family to be present for it. But I never was on the pitch doing anything, and so it's a little bit strange. And what happens for a professional sports team who is entertainers, that's their job, it's always even more strange to me. Like I don't really connect with it on the level that some of my friends deeply connect with it, and I don't have that same emotive response. It's an outgrowth of a different thing. So historically, first century before, first century afters, these kind of parades were designed to demonstrate a different kind of victory. Physical conflict, moral conflict, creates a different outcome than outcome of sport, athleticism, entertainment. And so these parades come from domination of other empires. They come from coronation events where a new leader is going to be recognized and seen. And they exist in a culture and a context that doesn't have distance access to media. First century context, if you wanted to send a message to somebody, you're going to mail that thing, right? You're going to write a letter, send a note out, and wait. It doesn't have that two-day, express delivery option. And even when John writes from his isle of exile in Patmos to bring the text of Revelation, he's sending it by the Roman mail system. He's sending out a letter either officially or unofficially hand-delivered to another audience. Well, victory parades are a different way to accomplish the same thing, saying, we won, or I'm in charge now, historically. That's concept number one. Concept number two is that this is going to connect biblical promises to a kind of kingship that was prophesied but not expected. The expected kind of king that Jesus was wanted to be was much more like David in his physical conquest than what they got. David engaged in victory parades too, right? Right, and that's a biblical event, an event recorded in the Bible. And you think about that setting, we read that biblical victory parade, particularly the one where he comes back post-Goliath, and there's conflict of a different kind. Because he's in the parade, but who's the king at that point?
Saul,
right? And so we read that narrative not to pay attention to David as the king, but David as the victor who trusted in the God of heavens, the Lord, when the king did not. And so we read it for a different reason. So all of that kind of helps us begin to see some of that. Further, let's get the setting here. Jerusalem, the city of David, as I sometimes referred to as a secondhand name, is the cultural, economic, and religious center of this entire region. Everything swirls around Jerusalem. And its population has its standard amount, but this time frame includes what event? What's been going on as we kind of get to this historic setting where Jesus is about a week out from his crucifixion?
Passover.
And what seems to be taking place when we read the text or a member of history with the population level in Jerusalem at the time of Passover? It is swelling like a Super Bowl. You ever try to make your way downtown when there is both a Braves game and a Falcons game on the same day? Anybody want to do that? Like, nobody wants to do that because it's already complicated to move through Atlanta. Now we have an extremely high, and what if there was, I don't know if this ever happened, we had a Braves game, a Falcons game, and UGA and Georgia Tech playing on the same day. And whatever other schools are there, what if they're all going on? Like just everything. How many of you are going to get in the car and say, you know what, we should go down to the center of Atlanta right now? That gives us a visual representation, or at least an emotional one, of what it's like for a actually relatively small area, which is the city of Jerusalem, during the Passover, when everyone is supposed to come. And not just individuals who are physically close to the city. Does the New Testament show us people coming from really far for the Passover? Any guy like from Egypt show up in the New Testament? Like he's traveled up there for that event? Yeah, we got guys that come really far. And that still happens historically to a certain degree, religiously, for segments of Judaism and religions in general. So now you've got theological possibilities, cultural possibilities, in a super compressed city. Everybody's there. This particular segment of Luke's gospel begins all the way back in chapter 9 and verse 51, where Jesus is being pictured in advance as being more than just a man and more of a king than a rabbi in that small little text there. But we get to verse 28. It begins very simply. I'm going to read just a little bit of it, and then we'll share the reading after that. But it says, verse 28, "And when he had said these things," that's the parable of the 10 minas that we talked about last week, "and when he had said these things, he went on ahead, going up to Jerusalem. When he drew near to Bethphage and Bethany at the mount that is called Olivet," or Olives, "he sent two disciples, saying, 'Go to the village in front of you, where on entering you will find a colt tied on which no one has ever yet sat. Untie it and bring it here.'" Let's pause there for a second and think about this. There's a couple of things that are described for us that are at times difficult to visualize. When you talk about going up, what does that mean to you? If I said, I'm going to go up. We think in topographical terms of elevation. Up means up and down. The way the biblical text is rendered, that's not how they use it. Up is their north-south designation, sometimes applied to the rivers. So it's not so much that he's going up a hill, that he's going up on our map is the first way to think about this. Second way to think about this is nothing is super far away. Like, this is not like a big distance that he's going from each of these spots. We tend to stretch the biblical world because we have a very big nation. And for us to go from Tampa, Florida to San Francisco, how many hours does that drive? I know the drive, so I can answer that question. That's why I'm using this one. But what do you guys think about how long that drive is?
3 days.
About 3 days, 30 hours. It's 50 hours following the closest, shortest roads you can find and basically driving the speed limit. Now, I was younger then. I can't verify that I was following it, but my current body, I can tell you exactly that I would be on the speed limit. It's not that much different. It's about 50 hours to make that drive. We don't bat an eye at saying that's really, you know, 50 hours, you're going to be lapping around Israel. Like, not just like, you know, and you think about our scale, the biblical scale, two vastly different things. Talk about the city of David. We're getting into a space that is incredibly smaller. And if you stand at the location, at the very grounds where we're looking at this Mount of Olives, the Mount of Olivet as it is in the ESV here, you can put your hand on olive trees that are as old as the day we're reading about right here. And you can look across a very short valley and see the temple. And you know you can walk from one side to the other in just a little while. It's like about an hour and 20 minutes to walk from the Mount of Olivet to put your hands on the base of the stones that make the retaining wall for Herod's temple. That's not even walking fast. That's just straight up just walking. Most of it's downhill on that journey. So that gets you guys a little bit, maybe more, into an idea of what's going on. This is all visual in the sense of they can see, recognize it. There's some sense of large amounts of people around. Presently, that whole area between the Mount of Olives and the temple space is all graves because that's post-Ottoman occupation where they turned all of that into cemetery space to defile the land for the Israelites and for the Jews. So it's all open, and you can see it. It would have been a little bit more green space during this time frame. So keep that in your mind, that this is not exactly like all just up ground, because it's all really level there, except for the valley between the Mount of Olivet and the temple space. Let's go ahead and pick along, and we're going to catch up here and talk about this colt in a moment, as it's brought for us in this text. And we're going to start in verse 32, and right now we're just going to read through verse 36. So, Michael, you're going to read first, right? 32 to 36 right now, then we'll start bouncing some verses around.
So those who were sent away and found it was just as he told them. And as they were untying the colt, its owner said to them, "Why are you untying the colt?" They said, "The Lord has need of it." They brought it to Jesus, and they threw their coats on the colt and put Jesus on it. And as he was going, they were spreading their coats on the road.
So what do you think about it for a second? Verse 31, which we intentionally skipped over, is instructions from Jesus. But what would you do if someone came to your property and just started untying one of your animals and just saying, "Yep, let's go. This one's with me." Would "the Lord has need of it" be a sufficient answer for you today?
No.
Most of them would be like, "You better get your hands off that animal. I got some plowing to do in the field later. That animal better be around because I need his work," right? We have theological reasons to doubt someone saying the Lord has need of it. There's other issues there. But that's our response, right? Joe, did you have something?
I was just thinking back, Mike. I reflect on that. There's a couple extremes that very young.
And no one's even been on it yet, right? So the picture here is showing us an unused animal. No known potential or skills just yet. No one's even sat on it. And someone's basically coming off, hey, Lord has need of it. Our natural skepticism be like, yeah, is your name Lord? Like you're trying to say you're going to sell and steal my colt. That's not what happens. Whomever it is who is the owner here or the individual being discussed is totally cool with this as a reason. Bobby?
We could probably see it better if somebody's out there getting out of a car.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, that's the next step of this. If someone was getting into your car, like, I got cars right now. If your car runs, you got a really valuable investment right now with the prices of cars, right? If it turns on and can go, it's a good car. Like, I mean, don't get rid of it. Keep feeding it for as long as you can. But there's something more going on. The text continues, and Joe, do you want to read a little bit for us, if you could? This is going to be starting in verse 37 for right now. Actually, we're going to go verse 36 through verse 39 for right now.
And as he went, they spread their clothes in the way. And when he was come nigh, even nigh at the descent of the Mount Olive, the whole multitude of the disciples began to rejoice and praise God with a loud voice, all the mighty work that they had seen.
Yes, just go ahead and go through verse 38 right now.
Saying, blessed be the King that cometh in the name of the Lord, peace in heaven, glory in the highest.
Right, I also want to point something out. I forgot to mention, when it says colt here in the Gospel of Luke, and Matthew and Mark give a more broad term, donkey, this is emphasizing the newness and youngness in Luke. And it's just translated colt because of the Greek word in the Septuagint does this. And so now we know it's young and we know it's gender in this context. And so this kind of helps us see more detail where Matthew and Mark are not looking at that particular detail. It doesn't include itself there. So it's there's no difference animal there, by the way. But looking at this next section, we begin to see from the Lord needs it, to a picture that goes, what's going to happen here is going to create a stir. Up until this point, for the most part, how has Jesus responded to people who want to make his name known?
Try to push it.
Yeah, it's like, it's not time for that yet. And we read that different ways. Sometimes we read it and think, oh, well, it's not a big deal. Like, maybe it's not his timing. We are perplexed by it. Like, why wouldn't he want that to be known? Why is he keeping it secret? The opposite happens here. As he's going into this last week, there's no hiding what he's doing. And this behavior is super specific to come in with people throwing that stuff down for him to tromp over. How many of you are going to take the coat you have on right now and go out to Bowlesboro and let us drive our colts over it, our cars? Like, not today for sure. Like, I need this coat, right? Has nothing to do with its quality. I want to stay warm, and I need that to stay warm. This picture here is showing that people are treating the arrival of this person who is more than a person in an extraordinary way. And it's regal of a kind. There's some biblical interaction that comes from Jesus' placement here. We see it in verse 38 in particular. It's a tie-in to Psalm 118, verse 26. It's a tie-in to Zechariah chapter 9 and verse 9, that Jesus now is more than an ordinary Jew present in Jerusalem for the Passover. Because you don't treat any old person this way. And you see his impact on the populace. Because it's not just one person doing this. So there's a gradual picture that a wave of event is kind of pushing itself into the city. The going into the city in this way that shows us, boom, something grand is about to happen. Boom, something great is going to happen. Now, as we kind of know, verse 39 is going to shift the circumstance just a little bit. But what we see here is really the arrival of a king. And the kind of arrival of a king that continues to shift what people want. Because does he come in with bloodied swords and the heads of the enemy of Israel?
No.
But what, does David do that? David did that, right? He came back with Goliath's sword as a trophy. Not just once, but twice. He returned from the slain corpse of Goliath. And then that sword went and set itself up as an icon of his victory. And when he needed it again, he went back and got it. As a symbol of his power. But Jesus comes in as a different kind of king. He comes in full of peace. And the pictures that are brought from the Old Testament shift him into the kind of king that is a kind of peace-focused king. Text continues, and we read this picking up in verse 39. Let's see. Let's go ahead and read verse 39 all the way through the end of our chunk. That's 39 through 48. And let's see. Gary, are you ready to read that for us? It's a big, long chunk, if you could.
Some of the Pharisees in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, rebuke your disciples." But Jesus answered, "I tell you, if these become silent, the stones will cry out." When he approached Jerusalem, he saw the city and wept over it, saying, "If you had known in this day, even you, the things which make for peace, but now they have been hidden from your eyes. For the days will come upon you when your enemies will throw up a barricade against you and surround you and hem you in on every side. And they will level you to the ground and your children within you, and they will not leave in you one stone upon another, because you did not recognize the time of your visitation." Jesus entered the temple and began to drive out those who were selling, saying to them, "It is written, 'And my house shall be a house of prayer,' but you have made it a robber's den." And he was teaching daily in the temple, but the chief priests and the scribes and the leading men among the people were trying to destroy him, and they could not find anything that they might do, for all the people were hanging on every word he said.
All right, so there's a way you can think about this. There's a metaphor that takes place of the stones crying out. That could be an allusion to Habakkuk. We might talk about that if it comes up in more detail from the dialogue. But you ever seen someone start to get excited so much about something that's going to happen that they almost start vibrating? Like they're like just shaking because it's like, is this something going to happen? And they know that's going to happen, and they're trying their very best to not let people know that this is like, Okay, so that's the level of anticipation that you should picture in your mind when you think about Israel physically. And Jerusalem specifically right now. The very stones themselves are shaking with anticipation for the arrival of the Son of God. Because we're thinking at first as we read it, almost from a human perspective, but think of a divine perspective. How long has this particular sequence of events been planned in the mind of God? for whatever way God measures time, he says this was the lamb slain before the foundation of the world in his writing through John and Revelation. So this lamb slain, who is an image that comes from Genesis to the Garden of Revelation, so garden to garden, is now having its high point. And Jesus' statement about, hey, I could hush them, but it doesn't matter. Because when he talks about the stones crying out, I thought they would literally speak per se. It's that everything speaks to this moment. And hushing them doesn't change anything. It's also interesting to note that at least in the Gospel of Luke, I think this is the last time the Pharisees are mentioned by name. Because there's a shift in conflict where it goes from the Pharisees specifically to the leading authorities generally. So priests, scribes, Sanhedrin, big picture shifts in the text. Further though, there's another statement that takes place. And this shows up a little bit later in what we read in verse 42. As he drew near, saw the city, he wept over it, saying, "Would that even you had known on this day that the things would make for peace. But now they are hidden from your eyes." So in part, he is answering the Pharisees a second time, but also in part, this text from Luke's perspective elevates the internal conflict of God as he weeps over Jerusalem with the specific moment that we're at. In Revelation, does John make mention of deaths in Jerusalem, by the way? Does he, if you remember from we read through Revelation last year? In that text, he says, the blood of the prophets cries out. And he lays the blame pictorially at the feet of Jerusalem itself. All that now is helping create this shaking space. How many of you have been through an earthquake, by the way? Like where you knew you were an earthquake? I got a whole bunch of those things. I got, like, you guys have tornadoes and stuff growing up. We had earthquakes. That was our thing. And so you can see that whole process of anticipation. Everyone's shaking, everything's shaking, and then it's super quiet. What's interesting here is you have that shaking anticipation, but it doesn't fade right away. Because he goes and does two other things after it. Before we get to it, though, how is Jerusalem going to respond to Jesus in the next 7 to 49 days? We'll get close to Pentecost with that math. They're not going to be too happy about him being there, are they? In fact, his disciples, the rulers, the common Israelite in the middle, are all kind of ending up on the same page, right? They either lose their belief or simply want him gone because he causes a conflict for him, for them individually or as a group. They all reject him in their own way. This is also kind of the prophetic space that you're finding in the text. This mix of Jesus arriving, temple picture, big picture, all of that summarized. And it comes to this last little picture. He enters the temple and he drives out what we sometimes call the money changers, but they're not exactly that. They're not changing one currency into another in a earthly currency to earthly currency, but they are exchanging money for something. Do y'all remember what they're selling there?
They're selling animals. They're selling sacrificial animals because a lot of the travel by these Jewish people, they could not carry sacrifice, so these so-called money changers were providing them with what they needed when they got there.
Yeah, how many of you, and I know this is me, have needed something really quick and gone to Dollar General when you're on a trip somewhere to buy that thing. This is not a dig at Dollar General, mind you. Was that a pretty good quality purchase that lasted a long time? Like, no, you bought it because it was there and it was cheap, right? And you needed it and you were satisfied, right? It was what you wanted it to be. But it wasn't good. In fact, very often you maybe have only got one or two uses out of it, and it was pretty much the time to throw it away. To a degree, if not even more so, the money changers in the temple are selling the cheapest things they could find, but making it seem like it was good enough. It's not so much that they didn't need to buy these things when they came to Jerusalem to offer for sacrifice, but if there was a low-cost option for them to give a not even suitable thing but looks like it was, little spit and polish, this one's ready, it's ready to go. It's the one that's going to be able to be offered for you in sacrifice, even though the law specifically said don't do that. Only offer proper sacrifices. Bobby? I already ran over. I apologize. I was on a one-track mind, and my brain only works right at one speed right now to keep myself going and moving. This is what's going on. So it helps us understand what should have happened and God in Christ's motivation. Now, we've seen this illustration. If you read other Gospels, there's a longer narrative of some of these kind of things, right? Where it talks about him blading or prating a scourge to do this. This doesn't have that long length here. He just drives them out and makes a bold statement. But his bold statement uses terminology that we later reread. Because when Jesus says this, he says, "It is written, my house shall be a house of prayer, but you have made it a den of robbers." There's nothing wrong with any Israelite making that sentence and saying that in the house of the Lord at all, right? Because they're quoting what is then attributed to God. But now, since we're informed that Jesus is more than a rabbi, more than a prophet, more than a king even, does that read differently once you know that? That Jesus is God? So when he says that it's written, my house, he's saying, what are you doing in my house? It is my house. We read it a little differently because we've brought our theology or our ideas about God to this passage. This comes from two specific sections of the Old Testament, by the way. It comes from Isaiah 56 and Jeremiah chapter 7. And it matches that same picture of people offering less than good quality sacrifices to the Lord. And we'll talk about that in a moment as we close out the text. And then he goes on and starts teaching in the temple. Day by day, he's teaching in the temple. So we've gone full circle. The first time we see Jesus physically in the temple, what's he doing? What do we find him doing in the temple? Like as in personally engaged. We know he's accounted in the census that has him coming in that area for his homeland and his birth. He's in the right zone. But as a young child, he gets left in the temple because he's teaching out of his age bracket. Like he's moved up in divisions. Like he shouldn't be in this group because he's too young. And yet he teaches as if he is mature in understanding. Now he's come back, and now he's teaching. So who knows where he is now? How many people know where Jesus is?
Everybody.
Okay, he's got a big king entry into the space. He sits himself right down in the temple space. And this temple space that's here, it doesn't look exactly like it does now, but it's about the same rough size as it is now. And now it's got the Dome of the Rock in place of the approximate location of the temple tabernacle space. But it's all super easy to see. And I said this in our Old Testament study of Kings recently. There's a word that's used in the Old Testament that can describe one of two things. Either the palace or the big temple in town. It's hakal or kal, and it's a house. But it's not just any house, it's the big house. It's the biggest house in the community, so everyone knows this is run by the big man. That's kind of a way to think about the word. Now you kind of have that idea. So Jesus is actually in the location that's the biggest spot in Jerusalem. In an open space when everybody's there. And he's not just hiding in the corner. He's teaching. And he taught when he got there. Because he kicked out those who were distorting God's plan, obviously for profit. Because they weren't selling these discount animals at a discount price. They were selling them at the going rate as if they were good sacrifices. All right then. What do we make of all this? What do you think is what's going on? What should we learn? What's worth paying attention to? Big ideas. This is mine.
The church is a house of God.
Right, there's some application for us to recognize that given that the Bible will speak as the called out, the assembly, and it's called out in the sense, not in a theological sense, but just assembled believers, the church is the household of God. We can make some application of this idea into our sacrifices, our commitment, our ideas. But one of the things I'll point out is that we have a king. Israel had no real king at this point. At least of the kind that they expected. They actually had one in Jesus. They just rejected that he was fulfilling that role as king in his work. And didn't want him. It doesn't mean they were going to set up a new Israel. It meant that they rejected him as a king just like anyone else would reject him as a king. I'll also add that this planned, glorious defiance of the Christ is something for us to kind of capture and recognize. He defies what the leadership in Israel wanted him to do. This is not what they had asked of him. They were fighting with him constantly, and so there's conflict there between Jesus and the Sadducees, Jesus and the Pharisees, Jesus and the scribes and the lawyers, Jesus and the Sanhedrin, the ruling council. So he's defying their will by going to Jerusalem and teaching it like this. Even if it's not explicit at times, it's definitely implicit. What else? Michael?
I love when they tell him to rebuke his disciples. And he says, you know, if they were silent, the stones would cry out. I love that declaration there. And it's followed up instantly by him caring for us. And he's weeping for them in the very next verse.
Yeah. You know. And again, it's nothing out of it. Like, inanimate things speaking for God, both metaphorically and literally, no problem. Like, it's certainly within God's power to do so. But the imagery is the most powerful. That the entire city, the very stones of this city, would cry out my presence if they kept silent.
It's like you can't stop this.
Yeah, nothing you're going to say is going to make this not go down. Gary?
Paul tells us that Christ is our pastor. So I see what's going on here as a fulfillment of Exodus 12. So it's probably, in my mind, the 10th day of the month when the lambs are selected, and he has until the 14th when they're sacrifice.
Yeah. Right. This is. There's a lot of stuff going here, and the Exodus imagery in Jesus is huge. A king is parting the sea of humanity to go to his sacrifice. Kind of matches a lot of the Exodus themes of parting, of arrival of God's people and God's Savior. You think of Moses going through, and all of those things are being tied up in this. This is what we expect. This is what we should have been expected. This is what God is teaching And you still people see people being people in all of this. You still have his disciples responding in various ways. You see those in power trying to cling to power and hold on to it for the very last gasp that they seem to have. But God's intention is going to come to pass. God had promised reconciliation. And even if you shut the mouths of the naysayers, reconciliation is still going to happen. The counterbalance, I think Michael pointed this out, of Jesus' compassion displayed in contrast to the stones as a metaphor. Jesus' care hasn't gone away. When you think about humanity that's going to reject him, he's still caring. The number of people who are willing to be present at his crucifixion as a supporter can fit in your hand. You don't need more fingers than you're given. But the number of people who reject him is presented to us in the picture as basically the city. The picture is that the city has many of his close disciples. That would include, as far as we can reckon, those who are present in this text. Those who went and got, those who made the way, those who shouted at his arrival. All of that then helps us capture the larger idea that the king that was promised and pledged has arrived. And when this shifts off the Jewish table into the Roman table, that picture will be heightened. Because that comes up soon as well. That's it for our time for our study this morning. I really appreciate everybody's participation. We'll be continuing in the Gospel of Luke next Sunday in chapter 20. Thanks, everybody.